Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 103 for May 19th, 2011, Cacklefest. Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, thanks for joining us again here Thursday night, as always. And as always, the Auto Extremist is in the house with me.
Buongiorno, Johnny.
Good to have you here, sir. And joining us today, too, is Jim McCraw's back with us. Great
nice
having
to be
you here,
John.
Jim.
Thank you.
Yeah. Go by Freelancer, or you?
Yeah, that'll work.
And later in the show, we're going to have Michael Nastas join us, too. We're going to be talking a lot about vintage drag racing and some other things.
Can't wait.
It's going to be good. By the way, too, remember, we had a great program last week. We got Sirens of Chrome. Margie Karevsky was here, gave us some more books. We'll announce the winners of these books at the end of the show. So we got to build some suspense here. It was a great show. If you haven't seen it, go check it out on the website. It was pretty cool. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was nice.
Peter, I see William Jeans gave you a good shout-out. I don't know if you saw that Auto Writers newsletter that goes out to all of us in the business, but he calls you the father of the automotive blog.
The godfather. I meant to send William a note about that. That was very nice, but I guess I am. That just means I've been doing it for too long. It'll be 12 years on June 1st.
Well, you started it. I think that's why he's calling you the father of it.
12 years. Good for you.
12 years of blogging. So, I mean, think about it. That is bleeding edge.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm a dinosaur. Why? Because I don't have a squadron of underpaid 21-year-old guys on energy drinks in their underwear posting 24 hours a day, all jacked up, you know. It was only meant to be a weekly magazine, and in this day and age, yeah, it's a dinosaur type thing, but still doing it.
Still doing it, because you wrote about something that we covered in Autoline Daily this week. The so-called Consumer Federation of America did the survey, and they found, to no one's surprise, that all Americans just about want better fuel economy. And they're saying that they want 62 miles per gallon.
Oh, yeah, they endorse it.
They endorse it, right.
Of course, I didn't ask the one question in my column. I said that I'm sure they didn't ask. Now, you understand that to get 62 miles per gallon, it requires several advanced technologies that will cost additional money. Would you be willing to pay A, $3,000 more, B, $4,000 see 5,000 more than, you know, they didn't ask that. And people don't want to pay for it.
No, they don't.
Somebody said on Facebook today, I wish I could remember the source of this, 62 miles per gallon is going to cost you $55,000.
Oh, that was Sean McElinden.
Yeah, from the Center for Automotive Research. He said if you want to build a fleet of vehicles, the whole fleet, remember, has to average 62. We're not just talking about a few high mileage cars that get that. The entire fleet has to average that. And he said, if you maintain today's performance levels, and we're not just talking 0 to 60, we're talking if you got to carry loads, if you got to tow something, you know, all of that mixed together. He said, you want a fleet that gets 62, you're talking $55,000 a vehicle. I know the Consumer Federation of America did not ask people that.
Of course it didn't. Yeah, if you just drove home and you've just filled your vehicle and you spent $75 and some crackpot calls you on the phone, would you like a vehicle? Sure, 62 miles a gallon, sure. But
why don't you ask him, hey, would you like $1 million? You bet I do.
Well, as I said, if you want to go to Five Guys and eat a double cheeseburger and fries and not gain a pound, yeah, I'd like that. You name it.
Well, did McAllen enumerate the technologies that it's going to take?
I was not at his presentation. I was actually part of the program yesterday, but I was early in the morning and I had left before he got there. So I don't know exactly what it is.
We won't get to that. I think what will happen is there will be a kaleidoscope of vehicles making up the nation's fleet. You know, there'll be what? 1% electric vehicles, whatever, hybrids, you know.
2% hybrids.
Yeah, right. Whatever it is. But, John, you need to set some of our viewers straight about CAFE.
Yeah.
And because I got people because I made a comment about CAFE, and Bob Lutz on the upcoming Auto Line made a, you know, real strong
argument about
CAFE. But right. I don't think people understand. Most people, the anti-Detroit people, equate CAFE with Detroit just, you know, blockading another, you know, advancement, you know, just like they blockaded seatbelts and safety. No, this is just another case of Detroit,
right.
You know.
Japanese small pickups.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Detroit fighting CAFE is just another example of Detroit's head in the sand, blah, blah, blah. But what's the real deal?
Well, the real deal is CAFE has never worked at all. If you say the reason that we have the corporate average fuel economy regulations is to reduce our dependence on oil, it has not worked at all. Ben, can you bring that chart up that we got? I hope he's got that there. This is from the Energy Information Agency, which is part of the Department of Energy. And it's a chart of gasoline usage over the last 60 years or so. And what it shows is we have not reduced our use of gasoline by one drop. Now, what you'll see is in 1980, there was a recession, and gasoline usage dipped a little bit then. In 1991, there was a recession. It dipped a little bit then. 2008, we had the Great Recession. There's a bit of a dip then. Here's the chart there.
But the long-term trend
look
is
at this.
Up.
And now we've had CAFE for 33 years. So we're three decades plus. We got all the evidence we need that this stuff just doesn't work. These regulations have not reduced our dependence on oil, not by one drop.
And the only way that's going to happen is if this government begins to set a sliding minimum scale of the cost of gasoline. And so that the American consumer knows that, well, it's never going to go below $5 a gallon again. One way or the other, it's going to be $5 a gallon. Then you let people decide. You let the free market decide. And boy, will the so-called CAFE go up then.
That's right.
But the government and the CAFE and the legislating fuel economy business was a disaster. The other thing that Bob talked about was how it was an anti-Detroit regulation, which was very interesting. And I'm not going to, you know,
Preempt all that,
because that's going to be shown in June. But that was a very interesting discussion.
And I can summarize it a bit here. But what he said is the way the regulations were written, it put an enormous financial burden on GM, Ford, and Chrysler, and about zero financial burden on the Japanese. And
yeah, well, when they all started with 1.6-liter little four doors that weighed nothing.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want to talk industrial policy or any sort of thing like that, or, you know, let's protect jobs or anything like that, you know, to Lutz's argument, you know, the original CAFE legislation really hurt the domestic automotive industry, not just the car companies, but the suppliers as well.
Yeah.
So he said in these next go arounds, the Detroit automakers are going into lobbying over this with their eyes wide open this time.
Well, you know, we're entering into a very dangerous, precarious period right now because legislators in Washington and Northern California are feverishly trying to ram this high-mileage thing down the collective country's throat. And
I think we got to bring the argument to them. and say, look, you're trying to reduce CO2. I don't necessarily agree with it, but you've got a legitimate right to push for it. Well, just look at that chart. CAFE has not reduced CO2 by 1 gram. Nothing. It has failed.
A century, it hasn't worked at all.
The government has to get out of the fuel economy regulation business. They should focus more on a cohesive national energy policy that actually makes sense and has teeth to it. I mean, really, if you know right now that in the future you're never going to pay less than $5 a gallon, you will make different choices accordingly. And, you know, it will change this country's usage of fuel. Now, people say, oh, you know, that's, we can't afford another tax. Well, you know, all the other machinery we put in place, CAFE and all the other bullshit we put in place to get us to get better fuel economy, like you say, it hasn't worked.
That's, to me, the most important measure. And, you know, there may be others who say, oh, well, if we didn't have CAFE, it would even be worse. And I'm thinking, really, you think people would go out and buy 7-mile-per-gallon cars to commute back and forth to work? I don't think so.
No.
I think people would pretty much buy what they're buying today based on today's fuel prices.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, and the auto industry has been arguing for higher fuel prices since I got into the business. So, and, you know, to your point, too, it is a very tenuous time because J.D. Power came out with a report today saying May sales don't look very good. Big time slowdown.
It's springtime. It's going into the prime selling season, and we're not selling. This is not good.
Well, I think, you know, it's a kind of, some suggest it's the worst sales month since last September, which is fairly grim. And, you know, what is it? Is it the high gas prices? Is it the bad weather?
I mean, nobody around the Mississippi these days is out buying cars.
No.
You can be sure of that.
No,
they're fleeing as fast as
they
can.
The floods, the tornadoes. It's just been horrendous.
Yeah, gas. Then, you know, there is low inventory at the Japanese dealerships.
I heard and read some speculation that because the winter was so lousy, spring was going to be good because people were all stuck in their houses from, you know, snow this high. And that didn't happen, did it? Now, says maybe a little bit in April, maybe.
Well, March actually looks like it was the best month so far. So things started to slow down a little bit in April. Nothing to get alarmed about. But let's see what happens, too, because J.D. Power is not able to track fleet sales. So they're reporting what retail sales are. Got to pay attention to it. Super important. But it's entirely possible that, you know, fleet sales will make up more of the gap, and maybe it's not going to look as bad as what they're reporting right now. Plus, as you guys know, the second half of the month is almost always the stronger half. Why? Because salespeople are trying to close down deals to, you know, get any kind of pop that they might monetarily wise. Dealers want to close out stuff, just get it off the lot. So usually the last week of the month is the strongest. So it's entirely possible the second half of the month will come in stronger than what they're reporting.
Well, needless to say, whatever happens, I wrote about this a few weeks ago, Detroit can't take their eye off the ball and assume they're anywhere yet. They've just got to keep going. And, you know, they're not out of the woods by any stretch. Now, the golden opportunity over the next 90 days is the fact that there are approximately 200,000 units of Japanese imports that are not going to arrive in this market. So as I wrote on the table this week, it's like, get your marketing on, boys and girls, and we'll see who is going to win those 200,000 units, or the majority of them, between GM, Ford, and Chrysler.
That's going to be Hyundai Kia.
And Hyundai Kia. We will see. Yeah, I mean,
that's something we
the new juggernaut.
Have to recognize that they are players from now on.
Oh, well, I think
if there's a big five, it's three and two Koreans.
Yeah. I think Hyundai Kia is going to be the number one imported automaker in this country within 3 years.
Give me a timeline here, Peter.
3 years.
Well, it's entirely possible they could surpass Chrysler and Honda in this market this year. They're that far behind Chrysler. Chrysler's that far behind Honda. In fact, Chrysler could even go ahead of Honda.
Yeah. I mean, but it'll be interesting. 200,000 units. I mean, so we'll see.
And, you know, that's at the end of the year, Peter. It's going to be a bigger dip because what everyone's saying right now is the big impact's going to be in the July-August time frame.
Because of the shipping lag and all the rest.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So even though the Japanese are saying, oh, we'll only be 200,000 units short, that's at the end of the year. Once they get back into production, I think we could even have an incentive war going on towards the end of the year. Hey, why don't we take a quick break here, and we'll get our guest in here. But we want to thank one of our great sponsors here, Chevrolet. The Chevrolet Cruze is the car that is taking the world by storm. And a key reason is all the equipment that it offers. A driver information center, a USB port, ambient LED backlighting on the dashboard, remote start with a MyLink app, two accessory power outlets, one in front and one in the back for the rear passengers, OnStar, turn-by-turn directions, free for the first 6 months. Whew, there's just too much to list here. And you can check it all out at Chevrolet.com/cruise. And Peter, you're driving a cruise right now?
Yeah, I'm driving the same car you had, the 6-speed Echo Cruise.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. As a car, period.
Right.
But the way they engineered it, it's just...
What I like about it, for a small car, it's comfortable and it's quiet.
Oh, it's unbelievably quiet.
Yeah.
I mean, the democratization of technology in cars today, I mean, they're just getting so good. And, yeah, it's an impressive package. I have to read something here. This guy, he's written me before. I've enjoyed your blog in the past, but your hatred of Chrysler is really starting to get old. Someone there must have really pissed you off in the past. Once a year or so, could you try to bite your lip, be objective, and say something nice? Alan, look. Let me just say this to all you Chrysler frickin' fanatics out there. I am a singular critic in this business. Okay, I say stuff that people don't want to hear. That's what I do. My assessment of Chrysler is dead on. Sergio Marchionne is the opportunist of the century. This guy strolled in with fiat money and was handed Chrysler by the U.S. government because they had no options. Just what, a week ago? Fiat put up $1.2 billion, the first money they have put up, period. Make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, Chrysler was handed to Marchionne. Now, he's a bright guy, but he's the opportunist of the century. I am not going to give Chrysler a free rein. They have done a superb job, and I'm talking about not the people that came with Marchionne. The people in the trenches have done a superb job, I think we'd all agree, updating their fleet. But now is when it's really, now the real nitty-gritty happens, because they got nothing new to 2014. So we'll see. But I don't buy this imported from Detroit thing. Hey, yeah, the M&M commercial was fabulous. Now they're trying to replicate that. Let me just say, as someone who spent 22 years in the auto business, you have a hit like that, the immediate tendency of human nature is to go back to the well. They're going back to the well, and I got to tell you, I'm not buying it. So to all you Chrysler people in the trenches, I wish you the best. Chrysler needs to succeed in this area. You know, it'd be great. I want to see all you dealers do well, but I'm not going to give them a free pass. So if you expect me to tone it down or anything about Chrysler, then you got another thing coming, because it ain't happening. I'm done.
He's done.
And with that, we're going to welcome Michael Nastas on the set with us here. Great having you here on After
Thanks.
Hours
it's
with
great
us.
Great to be invited, and I didn't really expect it, to be honest with you, because being a former baseball player, I did some pinch hitting and some playing off the bench in my time, but there was supposed to be somebody else here today, so I'm sitting in for Mr. John Lundberg, great announcer of drag racing, and I hope I can fill his shoes fairly well.
Well, thank you for saying that, and you're right. John was supposed to be with us, but... He was going to fly in from Tucson this morning, and apparently there was a big accident on the freeway. He missed his flight, and so so we've got you, Michael. So thank you for coming in.
I'm happy to be here and talk about the sport that I love, drag racing.
Yeah, and
amen.
And Jim McCraw is a big time fan of drag racing too.
We did some bench racing before we went on the air today, and I wish we could have taped that because I had a lot of fun talking to you about that. And maybe we can remember some of the things that we said.
Sure.
Sometimes.
Where would you like to start?
I don't know, but sometimes the best stuff is what doesn't come on the air. So I'll try to remember some of what we spoke of.
Is vintage drag racing? I mean, vintage sports car racing has been a real thing for quite a while now.
Right.
And there are some signature events across the country that we all. You know, Road America, Monterey,
right.
Road Atlanta, Watkins Glen, the major events. How has the vintage drag racing thing come online over the last few years?
I think the National Hot Rod Association really has brought this into fruition with their California Hot Rod reunions and the nostalgia races that are held all over the country. In Columbus, Ohio, I've been to a few of the Hot Rod reunions. Bowling Green, Kentucky, there have been some, too. At Milan Dragway, we've done this on a regular basis. We'll now have two nostalgia races during the course of the year, one later on in the season, and then this Detroit Dragway reunion, which comes up this Saturday, which I think is just going to be so much fun for people, not only older people like us who have been around the sport for a while, but younger people who can see the cars and hang out with the people who are still with us and ask them about the good old days.
So that's going to be at Milan?
Yes.
And just for those who don't know, Milan Dragway is just south of Detroit here.
Plank Road, take the exit at Milan.
23 south.
Follow the signs. It's never been different.
Now, the gentleman we were going to have on, did we determine, was he the originator of the...
Well, he was the voice.
Sunday
down at Detroit Dragway.
Something
right?
that I have to ask, John, because if you have been around this area for a long time, you remember an old radio show called See You at the Drags. And there was a gentleman named Big Al Pierce who did announcing in this area, too. And I think, I'm not sure, but I think he's the one that originated the Sunday. And as the old drag racing announcer, my good friend, the late Steve Evans and Dave McClellan have said, that kind of thing spread everywhere.
All over the tracks
in California and all over the Midwest and at English Town, that Sunday commercial.
Bob.
Oh yeah, I mean it was everywhere. It was like a flood, and everybody picked up on it. And that is the one phrase that people really relate to. If they know nothing about drag racing, they know the
what
Sunday.
You mean when you say Sunday,
I gotta tell you, Al Roker says it on the Today Show.
Yeah. Really.
Every once in a while.
That's funny.
And they put a little echo on his voice and everything. I'm going to date myself. I had an opportunity to see some fabulous drag racing events. I saw Art Malone. Didn't he have a rail called the Golden Rod?
Right, and he worked closely with Don Garlitz for quite a few years.
Yeah, too. But I remember seeing Art Malone at the Detroit Dragway in the Golden Rod. And Chris Caramassini's.
Yeah. Well, he's from Chicago. He doesn't really count.
Well, yeah, but it was cool to see him at night.
Detroit.
It was
he
cool.
frequented this area and still comes out here. As a matter of fact, just to qualify that, this weekend at Martin U.S. 131, Caramassini's is going to be there with his contemporary Top Fuel dragster.
He's the oldest licensed professional racing driver in the world.
And he is how old, do you think?
83.
Oh, my gosh.
We'll never know. He'll never tell either.
So why is vintage racing, drag racing, really catching on now?
Can I just...
Dude.
One of the if you go to one of the events, NHRA is up to 24 or 25 series points, professional races, all of which are televised. That has become... kind of scrunched. Everything is about TV. It has to fit in this time slot, so we have to do this and we have to do that. And it's that super professional drag racing. If you don't want to spend $1 million, you can still go build a fresh, brand new old car if you want and go to these events, which are much more low-key. It's about seeing your old buddies, and you fire it up, and if it doesn't run all that well, nobody cares. There's no points here. There's no money. There might be a trophy if you're lucky, which is the way it used to be. You win a race, you get a trophy, you go home.
And there's some gray-looking machines.
And the accent, the California accent is, of course, on old-style fuel dragsters with the engines in the front. Here in this area, Top Fuel was never that big a deal. It really wasn't. There are a handful of guys from Michigan that did well and campaigned all over the Midwest. But here it's much more about, like, gassers, classic gassers, the 33 Willys, the 40 Willys, the 55 Chevy with big engines that make a lot of noise.
Something with bodies that you can recognize rather than some rail job.
The Fiat altered.
Yeah.
Anybody remember the Dynamic Speed Shop Fiat? That was one of the first cars I ever saw go down the racetrack. And, man, after I saw that, I was hooked. I mean, that's really my first real memory of those cars.
But it really is. It's about looking back and remembering the way it used to be. And a lot of the drag strips, they play 50s music. They have live bands that play 50s music when they're not racing. And it's like a reunion atmosphere more than it is a drag racing atmosphere. And then when they finally do fire them up, I mean, the people just are glued, because maybe if they're 17 years old, they may never see a car like this ever again. If they only go once to one of the major ones like Bakersfield or Bowling Green, and they'll talk about that for the rest of their lives because it was so cool.
The thing that I think answers your question most specifically is that the nostalgia funny car has really come into being in the last 5 to 10 years. And not only are people building replicas of these cars, but they're bringing old body styles back with brand new themes and old bodies with upgraded chassis and designs and the safety equipment that you need if you really want to race. Now, I know there are a lot of people that want to recreate cars just to bring them out to the racetrack and bring back old memories, but there are people that really want to race these cars. And so they upgrade them, and they may not be cars that you'd ever recognize from the past. They didn't exist in the past, but for example, we have a gentleman locally named Steve Tomosic who runs the old Duran Chevrolet funny car that Big Mike Burkhart from Texas had. It's a 69 Camaro, and it is an absolute beautiful replica. And then we have Dick Harrell's funny car coming out. It's the old Fred Gibb Dick Harrell funny car that I believe Bill Porterfield, your friend, owns. Mm-hmm. And so those two 1969 Camaros ring true about the old days of being at Detroit Dragway and being at the old AHRA Grand National events, and those crazy funny car cavalcade of stars that were sponsored by Coca-Cola, which not coincidentally is the big sponsor of NHRA drag racing these days. And they do it Chicago style, where funny car pair after pair would come out, and they'd do a burnout, and they'd back up, and they'd do another burnout, and maybe a third burnout. And the top ET qualifiers from 30 or 40 funny cars in one round would come back for the finals. And if you remember Detroit Dragway, you remember that big dip in the right-hand lane where the cars would, like, go under and then come up, and maybe they'd get a little airborne at the finish line, and maybe they would, you know, like, tip over. It's a little scary. But those old funny cars that are coming back, and many, many of them being built these days, I think that is what really is spurring this nostalgia craze. And if I could call it a craze, I really think it's accurate, because the people are nuts about these cars.
I would call it a movement. I think it's going to be longer term than a craze. Crazes come and crazes go. Mm-hmm. I should interject here that funny cars were born right here.
Yeah, they started
in California, not in Minnesota, not in Pennsylvania, right here.
They were an offshoot of Pro Stock, and then they started, you know, playing with the wheelbase.
And again, because we got a lot of different people listening to this, explain what you mean by funny car.
The very first funny cars were 1965 Dodges.
Right.
The guys at Chrysler in that racing department were geniuses of their time. And they were involved with the Ram Chargers and the Motown Missile. And they said, if there's not a rule against it, if we move the rear axle up a foot and rewrap the fender skin around it, the thing is going to have a traction advantage that nobody else has got. And they did it. and an ambulance company in Birmingham, Michigan got the job to rebuild these cars with these shortened wheelbases, and then they put them out amongst their factory teams, Sox and Martin and Landy and a whole bunch of other guys.
And they were all lightweight, too.
They were very, you know, had acid-dipped bodies and aluminum hoods and all this other stuff and Hemi engines. And they looked weird. They looked funny because it was a full-size Dodge Coronet body or a Plymouth, and the wheelbase was shrunken by a foot. So they just didn't look normal. They looked funny. So that everybody started calling them these funny-looking cars or funny cars. Some of the purists, me included, tried to later on get that designation changed to fuel coupe, because they were all coupe bodies, but it just didn't work. People liked the
the public had already spoken.
1 year later, once Chrysler had done that, Ford said, "You want to see a funny car? We'll show a funny car." They got together with a company right here in Detroit called Logie Stamping Company.
I remember Logie.
And they said, well, what if we just put a tube, upper and lower tube chassis together with a 427 Cammer engine in it, and we just hinge the whole fiberglass body at the back so that you could get the driver in there, work on the engine real easy, and then when it's time to race, you just lower the body, latch it together, and off you go. And it weighs next to nothing, and it makes a zillion horsepower on alcohol or nitromethane. And the first ones didn't have blowers on them, except one in California, Jack Chrisman's car. And overnight, the flip-top funny car was born right here in Dearborn, Michigan. Huh. So don't let those California guys tell you any difference. It didn't happen in California. It happened here, sponsored by Chrysler and then later Ford Motor Company. And once the flip top showed up at the drag strip, all the other altered wheelbase cars just then obsoleted overnight.
It became a class.
Those cars got me hooked, and
there
I must say,
go.
out at Milan Drag,
that's Chrisman's car with the blower.
Yeah, that's the California car, but the Ed Sharpman car and the Dino Don Nicholson Comets were very prevalent here, especially at Milan. And then a year later, they turned into Cougars, and they actually looked like cats coming off the starting line, kind of leaping with the wheel stands. And I'm telling you, that hooked me permanently. I mean, if I like the dynamic Speed Shop car and Wally Booth's Superstock Camaro and Ron Mancini's Dodge going down the quarter mile, then when I saw those funny cars, those Cougar funny cars, man, I was just, it was over for me completely. And I'm sure I'm not alone.
I'm sure you're not. Hey, let's take another quick break here, quick commercial break. And we really want to thank Hyundai as one of our sponsors for AutoLine After Hours. Hyundai is known for the great value that it offers, but let's not forget about the technology. The Hyundai Sonata is the first vehicle in its segment with standard integrated Bluetooth hands-free phone. It's the first vehicle in its segment with factory-installed HD radio technology with multicasting. And it's the first vehicle in its segment with XM Nav traffic and XM data services. That, plus NHTSA's 5-star overall crash test rating and the IIHS top safety pick, explain why the Sonata is selling so well. And you can check it all out at HyundaiSonata.com.
I got to say, I really like HD radio. I think I might even like it better than satellite radio. Have you spent much time with HD?
I have, and, you know, some automakers do a much better job than others, because I was just in, I want to say, a 550 BMW, and it kept going in and out of HD, and I found it very annoying. In fact, I have found in my test car driving, Volvo does the best job of integrating HD into a car of all the other makes that I've been in. But
consistent strong signal, no braking.
Yeah,
up.
Well, you know, like you'll make a turn and all of a sudden it goes back to normal AM, and then you drive, you know, a couple of hundred yards and boom, it's back to HD, and then it drifts out again. But I did not have that problem with any Volvos. Mm-hmm. But hey, you know, one other thing I should mention for everybody out there. Show your support for AutoLine After Hours. You know, go to our website, click on those ads for Hyundai and Chevrolet and Bridgestone, just to let them know that you're supporting the show. Jim, tell me about this Project 1320 that's going on in drag racing circles now, because it ties in exactly with what we're talking about here.
It's a small growing movement. There are two things. One is called Project 1320, and for those who don't know, there are 1,320 feet in a quarter mile, and that's always been, you know, talking about going down to 1320. Project 1320 is over here, and the Quarter Mile Foundation is over here, and these are grassroots organizations, one of which is run by a woman called Tracy Rudka. Basically, I guess both of them really are, and they are going around the country with John Lundberg and a crew of professional video people doing interviews with the pioneers of drag racing so that they can tell these stories in the same way that some of the WPA projects were done in the 30s, only without the government funding, just to get them on video.
Capture
the history.
Before these guys die off, because they're getting old now, right?
Well, Chris Karamassinis is 83 and climbing, and Don Garlitz is in his late 70s, and there are hundreds of guys out there who have great stories to tell about how drag racing was formed and how it was regulated and what kind of fun that it used to be. And it's as American as baseball. We exported it eventually to the Caribbean islands, to Sweden and Germany and England.
Australia.
But drag racing started right here in the United States, and it's an American motorsport, and it deserves the same kind of historical undertakings as sports car racing and IndyCar and NASCAR and all the rest of it. So, and both of these things can be found by a simple Google if you're interested in trying to follow Project 1320 and or the Quarter Mile Foundation. I think they're both very worthy enterprises, and the missing guest, John Lundberg, could have told you a lot more about him because he's one of the people that does the interviews.
Well, if you come out to Mile and Dragway this weekend, John will be in the pits interviewing these people. And as we really need to emphasize, for those of you out in the audience, Detroit is the hub of this sport in so many ways. Now, California can take their credit, but we will give ourselves a little bit of credit for bringing people like Roger Lindemood, who will be out at the racetrack this weekend. If you remember the old Color Me Gone Super Stockers and Funny Cars, Roger is in his 80s, and anybody who was in their 20s and 30s is getting on in years, but Roger really is excited about being out at the racetrack this weekend. I believe one of his replica cars will be there, and he'll be able to sign autographs. I can't talk more. I could fill up all the space about the original Ram Chargers team. Of course, the Ram Chargers name synonymous with drag racing for many, many years, talking about the old AFX cars and super stockers that turned into flip-top funny cars and owning a business with performance parts that were available here for many years. And we have five of the original Ram Chargers: Dick Skoglund, Tom Coddington, Pete McNichol, John Worley, and the author of the book We Were the Ram Chargers, Dave Rockwell, is going to be out there. Now, the book's been out for about 3 years now, but you have an opportunity to get the book and have it signed by all five of the original Ram Chargers at Mile and Dragway this weekend for the Detroit Dragway reunion. Della Woods, great funny car pilot, I think doesn't get enough credit. She and Shirley Muldowney pioneered in the funny cars in the early 70s. And, of course,
yes,
Shirley went on to drag
Shirley
racing.
Shirley Muldowney from Mount Clemens, Michigan, not right. California.
Right.
Three-time Top Fuel world champion.
Of course, she made her mark being a Top Fuel champion, but drove funny cars at Detroit Dragway for quite a few years under the auspices of Cha-Cha Muldowney. But Della Woods, also a pioneer in the funny car ranks, and she toured the country in the funny car quite a bit, as well as working those old
That's a good point, that circuits. Women have been involved in drag racing far more than probably in any other series.
Well, at Milan, our percentage is probably upwards of 30% female racers right now.
Right now?
Really?
Night,
right? Yes.
Good for you.
Absolutely.
That's good to hear. That's great to hear, as a matter of fact.
And I mentioned the Dick Harrell funny car and Bill Porterfield. We got the Prock and Howell F Troop AA Gas Supercharged Willys that's going to be out this weekend. And we've got some nostalgia funny cars and the fuel altered. The Nick Tilley's Fiat's going to be out at the racetrack this weekend. We have Nostalgia Superstockers. We have a Gasser class. And you talked a little bit about the Gassers. The Gassers are really where this all started from. Gassers turning into A Factory Experimental, then throwing nitro into it, and then tossing a blower on, and then the acid dips bodies and the fiberglass bodies. And look where it's gone now. They're like technological rocket ships. It's just amazing how the evolution of that class has come on. But all these people are going to be out there at Milan this weekend.
Michael, for the same reason I asked Jim to do so, explain what a Gasser is.
Well, I don't know. The Gasser class is kind of nebulous in a lot of ways because they started with the modifications of the chassis. They jacked up their engines. They went fuel injection and then blowers, and certainly the AA gas supercharged cars of people like K.S. Pittman and George Montgomery were the rage in the late 60s and early 70s.
I remember seeing George run.
And we can't even forget about the fuel altereds, the nitromethane cars with those dinky wheelbases and the superchargers and just the handle.
The Fiat bodies were in the...
The big distinction, John, was if you built a Gasser, you were allowed to set the engine back 10% of the wheelbase, which helps traction a lot. And that's why a lot of them, that they used the older bodies because they were cheap. You could go to a junkyard and get an old Willys, but they look so cool. They put tires on the back that are this wide and tires on the front that are this wide, slide the engine back 10% of the wheelbase, put a blower on it, and those things wheelied long before anybody else did wheelies because the traction. And then if you take another 15%, so now you have a 25% engine setback, those were altereds because you could take one look at it and say, this doesn't look right. This has been seriously altered. That's because the engine is way back in the chassis. And then you put a blower on it and add some alcohol and nitromethane, and you get a fuel altered, which are still the most exciting cars in drag racing to watch because, as he said, they're on like 96-inch wheelbase chassis with some flimsy Austin Bantam Roadster body.
You're Henry J.
And they will not go straight. So you always see a fuel altered. Those guys really drive the cars. Most drag racers,
they look like rally drivers, huh?
Just left, right, left, just trying to keep it and it's going in a straight line because all it wants to do is wander around. They are so exciting to watch.
I think there was a lack of foresight in the Gasser class in that they were included in a group called Modified Eliminator, which eventually became Competition Eliminator. And so the people who weren't happy with index racing or couldn't find somebody comparable to do match races with said, we're just going to put on a blower and put as much overdrive as we can get into it and just go match racing because they could actually make more money that way instead of running in the classes or running for trophies or running in the old modified eliminator.
The Gasser circuits kind of grew up here and especially down in Ohio is really Gasser country. That's where Ohio George is from and the Rudka brothers and countless others. It was war every weekend at every drag strip in Ohio with the Gasser guys.
And eventually they went to methanol and nitro too, so that kind of eliminated the Gasser class. There was also a group called Top Gas Eliminator, which were front-motored dragsters with blowers, and they went the way of the Buffalo fairly quickly too, and everybody wanted to go faster. You know, speed costs money. How fast do you want to go? Well, I want to put nitro in it and go faster. And those Gasser classes and the Top Gas classes were eliminated for the professional ranks of the top fuel cars, really.
You guys got to tell me a term that I had never heard of before, cackling. What's that all about?
You're up.
You know, in these nostalgia races within the last few years, another aspect of them has been to put these supercharged machines or these nitro-fueled machines on the starting line and fire them up. And I've seen as many as 50 to 60 of them on the starting line. And at dusk, when the flames come out of the nitro pipes, it's quite a sight, but it's so loud, actually. When you've got all that horsepower.
One is so loud. Two, making a run is extremely loud.
If we're lucky, we'll have 15 of them this Saturday at Milan Dragway. If we can line them all up on the return road and people can actually see the cars with the bodies flipped up, and we can fire them all up and assume that they'll fire up, then we put on quite a show. It'll be a little bit more light than I'd like it to be. If it was around 8 or 9 o'clock, it'd be really spectacular.
And you see the flames coming
out.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But
and we'll put
supercharged. Explain the term cackling, Jim.
Well, when you have a 500 cubic inch Hemi style engine with a huge supercharger, and they call them 1471s, spinning way faster than the crankshaft. That's what he meant by overdrive. They spin the blower really fast, put tons of fuel through there. That when that engine is running, it doesn't sound like a NASCAR car or an Indy car or any other, because first it's 500 cubic inches, then you add the explosive nature of alcohol and nitromethane, and they sound like something monstrous is cackling, is coming after you.
It's that, you know, I can't even do it with my voice.
Even at idle, they sound like that.
Yeah.
And they have a characteristic. When you're in the car and you whack the throttle like that, it puts out this burst of sound and dynamic energy that's unlike anything I've ever experienced.
You feel it in your chest.
Absolutely. And then you, as soon as the guy lifts off, there's silence. So you go from whack, and this enormous burst of sound and energy comes out. And that's what they do at these cackle fests. They sit there, 4, 5, 6, 8, up to, I've seen 44 cars all running at
That's
the same
unreal.
Time.
Mm-hmm. That is unreal.
Straight down the center line of the drag strip at Bakersfield, and they whack the throttle, and the flames go up, and then they whack the throttle, and the California guys will do that until the last car runs out of fuel.
You gotta love it.
And they burn through a lot of fuel. So a 5, 6, 8 gallon tank, that's not gonna last long. But the sound sensation, and then by that time, with that many cars running, that much nitromethane, and it's a lot of it is just raw fuel.
Oh, here we go. A little bit of it.
Whack it once.
Remember dry hops? Funny cars used to do a burnout and then come back and do a dry hop, which was behind the starting line, kind of hit the throttle a little and then kind of lurch forward. They don't do that anymore because they'll break parts, but they used to do burnout and come back, do another burnout, do a dry hop, and then finally get to the starting line when their engine is just right as far as temperature goes.
That's cool.
There's just nothing like it anywhere. You, if you're a car weirdo, you have to go see the Apple Fest at least once in your life. And you will end up crying, mostly because of the nitro. It gets right in your mucous membranes and makes you cry.
Yeah. That and the nostalgia of it all, right? Yeah. Or maybe the pain of the noise, too.
It's fabulous.
Hey, let's take another quick break here. We've got to thank another one of our sponsors, and then we'll come back and do rapid fire where we get into Uh-oh. Questions from the audience.
Are we in trouble?
Yeah, not yet, not yet. But right now we've got to thank Bridgestone. Bridgestone is featuring its third generation of run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run-flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers, but the added mass and the stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third generation Bridgestone run-flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com. Okay, now it's time for rapid fire where we get into our audience questions. Ben, let's run it. Dr. Botox wants to know, come on, let's hear some cheating stories. Drag racers made the old NASCAR drivers of the 60s look like pikers. They were very creative with their cheating. What do you guys know?
Benzene.
Oh boy.
Benzene?
Benzene was used at one point in time. It was very underground and secret. Of course, fuel additives have always been a part of racing, and I don't know to what extent. I mean, if you want to call steroids cheating, that would probably be bending the rules quite a bit.
Was the steroids of drag racing.
Let's not forget that the Mercedes Grand Prix team created their own fuel that had benzene and some other highly toxic...
Toluene, probably.
Yes.
Because toluene is one of the T's in TNT.
And the Mercedes factory Grand Prix cars use this cocktail. And, you know, I've read extensively about how the mechanics of the fumes...
Well, it didn't take long for NHRA to catch up to that because they started doing fuel check after every run on every car, mm-hmm. you know, checking specific gravity and say, this run is disallowed. Go empty that stuff out of the tank and get some real fuel in there. Mm-hmm. But the cheating he's talking about is mostly done in the stock and super stock classes. You can, if you're careful, you can alter your own wheelbase by a couple inches and get away with it. And at the height of the old super stock racing, they were indeed acid dipping the front ends, putting very light primer and very light paint on the front end so that you get better weight transfer, moving the wheelbases around, changing the front ends so that you would have... The right front tire would stick out further than the left front tire, so you would get a better rollout through the lights at the start. And it just goes on and on and on. Mostly, the idea used to be in the 60s, when all Chevy small blocks looked alike, you couldn't tell whether it was a 265 or a 283 or a 327 or a 350. So the smart guys would run a 350 and say it was a 283. That went on all the time.
I wish John Lundberg were here to talk about the story of being at Milan in the late 80s when Bob Glidden was accused of cheating for putting nitrous oxide in his machine. Of course, he was the pro stock champion of all time at that point, and the IHRA asked him to tear down in public in front of his sponsors for Motorcraft, and he packed up his rig and left the race. And he and Billy Meyer and the IHRA had a huge lawsuit against each other. I was watching the old video of that, and Lundberg was announcing that race. And I wish he could tell us more, because it just seemed to me like all the motorsports shows on television called it a black eye on the sport, and Glidden was cheating, and he had his pants down. And there were several different articles in newspapers approaching this idea. Of course, later on, other people would be caught with nitrous oxide, and this is well before nitrous oxide made it into the pro modified ranks and all that. But that was an interesting transitional time where the sanctioning bodies were really looking hard at the hard runners and questioning how they were able to make all this performance happen, sometimes in pro stock ranks as much as a full tenth of a second. And the strange stuff that happened at that race at Mile in the Northern Nationals is just memorable. And one for the books.
Let's see. Jefferson's asking, why is the IRS investigating the NHRA? Never good when you have the revenuers down, you're breathing down your neck.
The NHRA, National Hot Rod Association, was established as a nonprofit company in 1951 in California. And that management stayed around for a very, very long time, the original group that founded NHRA. They retired, they died, they moved on. The company, they call it the company inside the walls, changed hands, changed management, and acquired these season-long sponsorships that they have now, which is not the way it started out at all. It was trying to just keep kids from getting killed by racing on the streets. So let's build some drag strips where they can race safely. And that's what the original intent was. And now it seems some people have said, wait a minute. If the top two, three guys at NHRA are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, how can this still be a nonprofit? Aren't you supposed to plow the money back into the association? So someone has brought suit. And so sooner or later, I guess there'll be a court case and the IRS will get into it and look at their books and see how it turns out to be a nonprofit that can afford two or three guys at $600,000 or $700,000 a year each.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll bet that gets changed. Comment from Jim. He says, I think the retro drag racing thing is popular because it puts the show back in drag racing, as today's cars are so fast, it's lost its show quality.
One of the points that he made is that it's become so corporate that the person who has the most money wins. And with nostalgia racing, it's more for fun than anything else. If somebody doesn't win a race, that's fine. We came out, we made a good show, we made a pass, people like it. So the competitive part of it is not so much pronounced. Although I can tell you, when those nostalgia superstockers and those gassers get out on the racetrack, they're going at each other, and there's no love lost between them. But they do want to put on a good show for the fans, and I think that's something that may lack in the current professional ranks. Would you say that that's what it is?
Yeah, these nostalgia events are really about the show and the fun and remembering the way it used to be. Mm-hmm. And really, nobody cares who wins or who loses.
Or knows the outcome from the beginning.
Hey, we've got some phone calls coming in here. Ben, let's bring in the first one.
Hey, people. This is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah, I was a young buck in the late 60s, early 70s, and I went through that drag racing. It was fantastic. Funny car, if I remember right, I think it started out as A, factory experimental AFX cars, not super stock. I remember when they first came out, and I could see why you're saying that they did look kind of funny, but man, did they run. And I'm glad to see it come back. My opinion is the death of drag racing came with bracket races. The first time I saw a car go through the traps with its brake lights on to win a race, that was enough for me. I just left it and never came back.
How about throttle stops, too?
Thanks for the show, and thanks for a little trip back in time.
Yeah.
Later. Bye.
Thanks, Youngblood.
Thanks, Youngblood.
So explain this bracket racing stuff a little bit. For
Boy, it's hard. I mean, maybe that's the problem that he has with it. It's so complicated.
All of the sanctioning bodies have rule books, and some of them are very, very thick, and they got thicker and thicker all the time because the associations wanted to please the manufacturers and keep everything straight and legal. And it got to be such a pain that a lot of people just abandoned it. And bracket racing is simply saying, my car can run 10.90 seconds every single time. What can yours do? So you go to Milan and you put 10.90 on the side window so they can see it. The guy who pulls up in the other lane has 14.30 on his window. He knows his car. He knows that day at that hour with that humidity and all the rest of it, it's going to run 14:30. The guy who runs 14:30, he leaves first. The guy who runs 10:90 chases him down. And that's the essence of drag racing. Mm-hmm. Theoretically, it's a tie.
Mm-hmm.
Because
if everything runs ideally, you hit the finish line at the same time.
But if my reaction time is better in the 10:90 car, I will beat the 14:30 car. If his reaction time is better, if he shifts his manual transmission better than I can do mine, he beats me. That's the smallest nutshell I can put it into.
Okay.
That's what
Youngblood's right.
But the purpose of it is to even the playing field so that if you have a street car or a Buick Roadmaster, I know a guy named Ron Hager out at Milan who deep stages his Buick Roadmaster and wins tons of races. And then you've got people who have a lot of money to put into a rear engine dragster or some more powerful machine that can run the number two, and it evens the playing field so that everybody has an equal chance to win. Now, obviously, the best driver is going to win. The person who knows their car and their tuning is going to win, and those people are going to be in the winner's circle a lot. But it gives everybody an opportunity to race no matter how much money they have, and that's why bracket racing is established.
And the rule book is this thick now. Because
there are no rules.
They look at the car, they check and make sure the tires are decent, the cage, a fire system, maybe if it runs quicker than a certain cutoff, they'll demand that a fire system and at least the top of a fire
just sort of safety stuff.
Helmet, maybe gloves, but that's it. You don't have to say, oh, I'm sorry, pal, these cylinder heads have the wrong number on them. You're out. It got to be that bad in the old super stock and stock ranks. And as he said, one whole eliminator was eliminated by the sanctioning bodies.
And eliminated the factories, too.
Hundreds of cars obsolete. So now you take this obsolete car, you take it to Milan, you put 8.90 on the thing, you say, I can run 890 five times in a row. If I do, I'm going to win the whole race. Hmm. And all those technical rules get pushed aside. It's you, the other guy, and the Christmas tree.
That's the short answer, and by the way. There is a much longer procedure in terms of reaction times and how close you can get to that number within a hundredth or a thousandth of a second. I mean, it's a bit confusing for people, I have to admit.
Ben, let's bring in the next phoner.
Hey, John, we're from San Diego. Andy, we're on with the next Camry is going to look like. I think it's going to be out in a couple months. I can't believe there's nothing on it. And how do you think the Japanese are going to respond when they get their production back up? I think they're going to really come out with some serious sales and trying to regain sales as much as possible. Any thoughts? Thanks.
Yeah, I don't know about the new Camry. We'll see what happens. My guess is Toyota's very conservative. The Camry's their biggest seller. They're not going to mess with success.
Well, the earthquake and the tsunami has everything to do with it, doesn't it? I mean,
well, not in terms of how they're going to redesign a car, but to the question, there's no doubt whatsoever. The Japanese automakers are short on inventory right now. Their sales are going to be impacted by this. When they get their production lines back up and running, I would suspect that somewhere in the September time frame, we're going to see all kinds of screaming deals because they're going to have to do everything to get people back in the showrooms, remind them that they've got cars again. That's how I see it.
Yeah, I agree totally.
And wouldn't that in some cases extend the life of some current models like the Camry?
Possibly. You know, for example, we know that this new station wagon version.
You wouldn't want to shut down and do all new tooling and go to all that expense now, would you?
Well, you know, but as you know, this is a three-year process to bring a new car to market. And once you pull the trigger and start cutting dies and all that, it's real hard. Yeah, you can delay it a little bit. But once you've started to make that financial commitment,
let's sell all the ones we have that are on the current platform and the current style, and let's discount them and move them and get them out.
Yeah, but remember, their problem now is they just can't build enough cars, and that's so they're running out of inventory. They say, and I'm sure they're right, that they'll make it up by the end of the year. And as they make it up, that's when I think they're going to have screaming deals going to try to get people back in the showrooms. And so, as far as redesigning cars or delaying programs, I don't think that's going to be impacted that much, not that much. Ben, I know we've got another phoner here. Let's bring it in.
Hey, how are you guys doing, John? I just want to compliment you guys on a great show, especially the Drive Racing Legend. My name is Jim. I'm calling from the U.S. Virgin Islands. It's very inspiring to watch these guys talk about all these old drag racers. I got one question for John and Peter. What made you guys enter the car entertainment or news media market? Was it from drag racing, NASCAR? Which one of the series helped brought you guys into the world of cars? Thanks.
Oh, yeah, interesting question. It was a little hard hearing, but what got you into cars, Peter?
Well, I grew up in a quintessential car family. A lot of the GM names that people read in books, like Bunky Knudsen and Ed Cole and Zora Duntoff and
Bill Mitchell.
Bill Mitchell lived down the street from me. I mean, they weren't,
they weren't names in books to you.
No, they were, hanging out at the house or, around. So I was immersed in it from birth, so.
You mean you didn't want to go into accounting? Not that there's anything wrong with
that. Yeah, motor racing is what got me into cars, and I don't know why, because I didn't come from a family that was really into cars, even though my father was an executive at Ford. He wasn't on the car side of the business. And he was transferred down to Argentina. There was a series of racing there called Turismo de Carretera, which was old 40s era Fords and Chevys and Dodges that they raced out on the roads. In fact, that's where Juan Manuel Fangio got his start, was running in that. And because that was local and that was the scene happening when I was a kid, that got me into it and started getting me interested in more racing. And then I really got into Formula One in the 60s. Huge fan of Jimmy Clark. Huge fan. And, you know, that was one of the things as a kid that really made an impact on me was when he was killed. I mean, it was like, wow.
And let's not forget the impact of the movie Grand Prix, which to certain people, certain age, that was huge. Ask Bobby Rahal.
Oh, I was totally
still one of the best opening sequences of any movie ever made.
Very exciting, even today to watch.
But you asked Bobby Rahal, and he said, "Boy, once you saw that, you wanted in." You know.
Yeah, I guess we all have some debt that we owe to our fathers. Mine took me to the old Langhorne Speedway, north of Philadelphia, when I was like 2.5 years old. And I heard those old flathead engines.
Boy, that was a legendary
place.
And
I said, wait a minute. I like that.
Here's another question. Has the Speed TV show Pinks helped drag racing? And Pinks, for those who don't know, are guys get in, they race down the track, and the loser loses his car.
I think for the person who called earlier that's not really keen on bracket racing, it has, because this is heads-up racing, and they try to gauge the cars accordingly to get them all to run the same time so that they can run heads-up. Now, we have a program, the AeroQuip Heads-Up Performance Program at Mile and Dragway, where they're all running heads-up, but they're also not street cars or even bracket cars. These are cars that are just monsters. They're almost like pro modifieds, or at least pretty close to pro modifieds. So I would have to say that the Pinks program, even though I think the All Out show now is done, and I'm not sure that the Pinks program as an entity is going to continue. Maybe they're going to go on hiatus for a little while. But yeah, I think it's helped the sport in terms of bringing new audiences into it. And you also have to think the sport compact craze of the last, and this was a craze, I think. I don't know if it's dead or not, but the sports compact drag racing series has kind of toned down. But it gave people in Japan and Aruba and the Caribbean islands and maybe our friend from the Virgin Islands an opportunity to see a different kind of drag racing.
Great point.
I should, for those who are less than 100 years old, the name of that show derives from the old California registration slip, which was pink. And if you raced for Pinks on the streets on Van Nuys Boulevard, that's what that meant. I go home tonight with my pink and your pink because I own your car.
That happened on Woodward Avenue, too, I have to say. You know, as a person who really believes in drag racing, as opposed to street racing, bring people off the streets and into an environment like Mile and Dragway where it's much safer and certainly not illegal, you know, we can get that kind of attitude off of the public freeways and the public byways and get it into an area where you can have fun without it being illegal and cops chasing you. But, yeah, I think, you know, running for Pinks is definitely a long, long-served term. It's been around for a while.
I'm glad you said that, Jim. I never knew that Pink was actually the registration. We'll make this the last question here. Jim Haynes says, with Peter always talking about the Speedway and IndyCar needing to promote new technologies for the future, I wonder if they should have a modified Chevy Volt for the pace car to kick off a new era.
I wouldn't be surprised if we see GM do something for next year when they're bringing the Chevy engine back to the Speedway. I wouldn't be surprised if they try something different.
That could be kind of impressive to see a Volt as the pace car. That would be, you know, a signal of a new era.
Yeah. Or perhaps a Volt coupe that doesn't look like the current Volt.
And maybe the green sexy racing idea is just starting to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see electric cars every once in a while at the drag strip, but not that much. We see cars on propane. Certainly methanol has come into the sport in a lot of ways, and that's probably... There's a guy named Joe Mesquita who ran a natural gas dragster for many years in the Super Comp class. Very competitive and very clean. You know, water vapor is the byproduct, the end product. And I thought Ford was developing that as a passenger vehicle option, but it seems like they're not even close to being interested in
that. They are bringing back natural gas vehicles right now.
Is that right?
They're going to have three or four of them, mainly for the commercial end of the business, not so much for retail.
Yeah, Roush is doing a lot of work with natural gas.
Well, he's actually going with what they call autogas, which is liquid propane. So that's what Jack's really pushing these days. But we should wrap up this conversation. But before we do it completely, as I said at the top of the show, we'd be giving away, we've got four extra copies of Sirens of Chrome, which was part of the feature of last week's show.
Drum roll, please.
Drum roll, please, right.
I had my drum.
And the winners are Guy Martineau, Stephen Nogler, Jeffrey Taylor, and Paul Graziano. They entered our Facebook and Twitter pages, and they won these books, and we'll be getting them out to you guys. But anyway, Michael Nastas, thanks so much for coming on. This has been a real joy for me to hear all about this.
Well, I don't know everything, especially not what John Lundberg knows, but I do my best. And once again, John will be at the Detroit Dragway reunion this Saturday at Mile and Dragway. And it's a star-studded lineup. It's our second annual event. We celebrate the Double D, just like we celebrate drag racing every weekend at Milan, and we hope you'll come out. Please be welcome. We want to see you out there.
That's great. And Jim McCraw, thanks so much for coming in. It's always
my
a pleasure to,
great
to have you here.
Great fun talking about my favorite sport.
And Peter, as always, man, great having you here.
Great.
And thank all of you for having tuned in.
Visit our website, outofline.detroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Outofline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Outofline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outofline.detroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.